President Donald Trump has been impeached by the House of Representatives. California and Nevada members of Congress, in fact, most members of Congress, voted along party lines on Insight, the politics of what's next. I'll talk with constitutional law professor Leslie Jacobs from the McGeorge School of Law. Then a phone conversation with Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg. This is about housing people who are homeless and how a statewide mandate might work. In our second half hour, Hollywood movies. From Dark Waters to Greta Gerwig's Little Women and Star Wars, there are big films on the big screen. Derek Bang will join me for some box office chat. And then some holiday music shopping for anyone who loves rock and roll. Dennis Newhall features some new box sets in this end of the year sound advice. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. The vote happened along party lines. President Donald Trump has been impeached by the House. All California and Nevada Democrats voted yes on both articles. All California and Nevada Republicans voted no on both articles. President Trump was holding a rally in Michigan at the time last night, so his reaction was reported to be in the moment as he got word. Here's some of what he said on stage.
You're declaring open war on American democracy. You are the ones interfering in America's elections. You are the ones subverting America's democracy. We did nothing wrong, nothing whatsoever. This was just an excuse.
Then in making the announcement, House Speaker California Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi said this.
December 18th, a great day for the Constitution of the United States, a sad one for America, that the president's reckless activities necessitated us, our having to introduce articles of impeachment.
Speaker Pelosi then told reporters that she can hold the articles indefinitely and not send them on to the Senate. So today there has been a lot of discussion about what exactly that means and what might happen next. Law professor Leslie Gilo Jacobs is joining me in the studio. She teaches constitutional and government law at University of the Pacific's McGeorge School of Law. It's great to have you back in the studio. On this day in particular, when history is being made and the speaker says, a great day for the Constitution of the United States, what does that in law terms mean?
Well, it means that the procedures of the Constitution have been followed here in the sense that the one way to remove the elected official, the president, prior to an election is to go through the impeachment process. And so the first part of that process in the House of Representatives has happened. And this is what we call checks and balances.
Can I get your overall impression, your broad view of what the country has just been through, what Congress has just processed, and where we are at this point in time?
Well, where we are in this point in time is, again, in the middle of this process. And what the country's processed is watching democracy in action. That is, we say that, oh, it's the members of the House who are voting, and oh, it's the senators who will be voting. But really, there are representatives, so we're the ones who are voting. And so as we watch this, we should be communicating with them, and people across the country should be, and they should be reflecting the point of view of the population.
Talk to me about, in these articles of impeachment, this phrase and article being obstruction of Congress. There was a lot of debate, particularly from the Republican side, as to whether that even exists. What's the legal take on obstruction of Congress?
Well, I should say that impeachment doesn't have to happen according to things that are defined as crimes. That is, it's high crimes and misdemeanors. And so the House can define what those things are. So obstruction of Congress refers to the president's blanket refusal to produce any documents and his order to former and current officials not to give any testimony whatsoever. And so the thought here is that an impeachment process has to have evidence, and it's the responsibility of the president to produce at least some of that.
To you, does one article versus another have a more clear and defined pathway? Is there more, and I guess I go back to the word
clarity in one versus the other?
Well, they're about different things. I mean, the first one is the substantive act of akin to bribery, which is offering something of value in exchange for an official act. And so that's what that depends upon. And that depends upon all the evidence that we heard about the transcript of the telephone call and all those sorts of things. Whereas the document one is fairly clear in the sense that Congress has asked for a lot of things and the president hasn't given them. An argument could be made and has been made, actually, by Harvard law professor Dershowitz in an op-ed that, oh, gosh, you know, these things are making their way through the courts. And so it's premature to be doing this. But I will say that in other impeachments, there's been these types of claims about not producing things.
It's interesting how the timing of the event yesterday with the impeachment vote parallels to 1999 and it being today, the anniversary from 20 years ago. What about the swiftness? Republicans have called into question in different ways whether enough time was spent, whether enough investigation could have been done. Is that an issue of concern to you?
Well, again, of course, the other side is we asked for more evidence and you didn't give it to us. We weren't able to produce it. So it's a judgment. And this whole process, what's very interesting about this process is it is a political process, right? What we would expect with a criminal trial is that we have a judge who has life tenure, who's sworn to be impartial. You have jurors who are drawn from the community, sworn to be impartial. Here we have a system that's a political system. And the framers knew it was going to be like that. So it's up to the political actors here to make a judgment about when the evidence is sufficient and whether to take more time out of other business to go through this process.
Isn't it astonishing on some level that so much of this was thought about so long ago? The what-ifs, the plans, the contingencies, the rules?
It's very interesting. And what's particularly interesting here we have a situation with the previous two that we've had most recently with the Nixon and then the Clinton.
The previous two impeachments.
Yeah, leading to an impeachment. Mm. With Nixon, it was a Democratic House Senate. And with Clinton, it was Republican. And then here we actually have the Democratic House and then the Republican Senate. And then the first part going through, but then Speaker Pelosi sort of stepping back and saying, well, wait a second here. We're going to be moving over into the Senate. And the framers of the Constitution said it's a 2/3 majority vote there. And so when I look at that, I realize they were thinking about this type of system. That is, you can have an impeachment by just a flat majority. And so the party in power can win the impeachment, which is essentially an indictment. But they were saying, you know what, to actually remove somebody from office, it's got to be a supermajority. And so it really won't be a straight line party vote. It has to be something that is bipartisan unless there's an unusual balance in the Senate. So we see that going on now, too. That check that's happening with that supermajority in the Senate, and the framers set that up.
I'm talking with McGeorge Law Professor Leslie Jacobs. President Trump did make the point that every single Republican voted against the articles of impeachment. He said, we didn't lose one Republican vote. It should be noted there are four vacancies in the House. We had in Tulsi Gabbard the present vote. She said present as opposed to yay or nay and abstained. How do you think that will play in time?
Well, it just depends. All the representatives and senators will be making their own judgment. And quite frankly, I'm not sure they're worried about time more than the present, about how it's going to look. And so she's going to have to make that judgment.
On Article 1, it was 230 yeas, 197 nays, and 3 no votes. On Article 2, 229 yeas, 198 nays, and 3 no votes. Again, the present vote on each of those. Let's get to Speaker Pelosi talking about this possible delay. She told reporters she would hold the articles back until it was clearer that the upper chamber would give the case a fair hearing. That's how the New York Times reported it. What's at play here? What's she doing and what latitude does she have for this move?
Well, the way that the rules work is, first of all, the Senate can do whatever it wants. And it has rules established, but it doesn't need to follow them. So really, the way that you look at the Senate is, for procedures, you need Mitch McConnell needs 51 votes. Again, for conviction, you need the 67 votes. But 51 votes for any procedural move, and there are 53 Republican senators. And so it's those middle senators who have thus far been exerting pressure on what the procedures would be. That is, it's not going to be exactly what the president wants. These middle senators are saying, wait a second, we need to have a fair trial. We're not going to agree to everything. But now Speaker Pelosi is coming in and saying, well, you know what? I'm going to exert some pressure here, too, to the extent you feel it, which is the Senate rules say that you don't start until we deliver this to you. And we have to have a vote on our managers, and then we deliver it to you. And so she's using that as leverage as well to say that you might not get to start this trial quickly or whenever you want and get it over with, if that's what you want, until you agree about procedures that we think are fair, too. So she's using it as a bargaining chip.
What do you know about the history of using this strategy, calling into situation the delay, the possible indefinite delay of moving articles?
Oh, I don't think people have thought about it before. Again, this is actually law professors being relevant. Harvard law professor Larry Tribe wrote an op-ed and brought this up and said, you know what? The Democrats should consider doing this, not delivering these things right away. And it's careful reading of the rules that caused him to realize that. And that's what started the conversations here. It's really rather in the past several days that this has been taken seriously.
Speaking of the rules, it was quite an education watching and listening to the hearings and watching the rules of order invoked and used and the choreography that happens. And I can't imagine that every member of Congress knows the rules in and out, but the conversations move so quickly, there have to be advisors for every member to know what the possibilities are.
I suppose that's true. But, you know, we don't watch these hearings that often. And they do follow these rules of order in other hearings as well. And so they're accustomed to having a chair up there and then Madam Speaker.
And yielding 35 seconds.
Exactly. And you know, having the time and giving it away. So they're accustomed to that.
Well, all right. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, in the Senate trial, of course, if we get to one, it will be interesting because the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court is the one who's the presiding officer. And so he will be the one making the judgments. Although what's interesting, too, is 51 senators can vote to overrule him. So it's an interesting procedure.
How might that go? And under what expectation does Mitch McConnell fall for paralleling the trial of Andrew Jackson, which I guess is the template here, or was the template in 1999?
It was. It sounds like they've been talking about paralleling the Clinton trial. And so the Clinton trial it was actually 24 hours for each side to present their case, which sounds like a lot. But then also there was no evidence presented until the senators heard everything, the arguments, and then they made a vote about whether to have evidence. And there was a little bit of evidence presented, but it was by videotaped deposition and not live. So that's actually a big question here. And that's what Pelosi and McConnell are fighting, or Schumer, I suppose, too. He's the Senate person, are fighting about, which is whether any live testimony will come in. And again, that's a 51-vote senator decision.
As you're watching this, do you have an expectation? Do you have an idea of how you think the Senate trial would go in this case?
I have a hope that the minority leader and majority of the Senate, Schumer and McConnell, will sit down. It probably won't be till close to the trial, but that they actually will hammer out rules of procedure. And again, that's a Clinton precedent, which is they did hammer out bipartisan rules of procedure. They had a unanimous vote in the Senate to have those rules of procedure. And so at least the way the trial went was orderly. And it is my hope that that's the way it'll go. The other option would be that every single decision is made by a vote of the senators. And that just seems like a circus.
NPR listeners might have heard Nina Totenberg reporting and sharing her conversations with Trent Lott and Tom Daschle from 1999. One final point I would like to make, and that is that we heard from the Russian leader overnight, Vladimir Putin, who says he expects President Trump to stay in office. And millions of Americans believe the same thing because of what we're talking about, the Republican majority. Are there any unknowns, any variables to that other than what seems to be a foregone conclusion at this point?
20 Republican senators would have to vote to convict. And so something very unusual would have to happen. And I don't think any of us see that on the horizon right now.
Thank you, Professor Jacobs. Glad to have you here today. I'll add this programming note. Issues surrounding that Democratic debate in Southern California have been resolved. So the debate among the seven candidates for president, Biden, Sanders, Warren, Buttigieg, Klobuchar, Yang, and Steyer, will begin at 5 p.m. today here in the West. The debate is sponsored by PBS NewsHour and Politico. So NPR and CAP Radio will carry the debate live. And again, that special coverage starts at 5. My thanks again to Professor Leslie Jacobs. She is a constitutional law and government professor with University of the Pacific's McGeorge School of Law. We are going to shift now to the topic of homelessness. On the phone is Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg. Mayor Steinberg, thanks for joining us. I know you're always stepping out of a meeting or into the next one, but I appreciate the time.
Always have time to talk to you, Beth.
So the Supreme Court on Monday decided not to review this case out of Boise, which set up discussion of whether sheltering people who are homeless should be or could be somehow mandated. And you're joining us today to clarify some of the comments from our special on homelessness, which was Tuesday. And I think that conversation is merited. So let's get to the issue of a mandate. For you, who is the mandate aimed at?
The mandate is aimed at government at all levels. And just to go back a couple of days, the Boise case where the Supreme Court essentially upheld the Ninth Circuit decision that law enforcement cannot break up tent encampments unless they have beds to offer the people who are unsheltered and homeless. My response to that was and is, I think this calls the question, because if we can't enforce, which has its limitations, obviously, to begin with, because it really is just moving people around, the only option left is to do the right thing, which is to bring people under a roof. What I am calling for is a legally enforceable government mandate that government bring people under a roof, with an emphasis on permanent housing, but navigation centers and shelters as necessary. Step back again for just a moment and ask this. Is there any issue of great societal consequence that we deal with in California, in this country, where all that is done is essentially voluntary? It's not voluntary for the government to provide public schools for kids. It's not voluntary for us to offer health insurance now under the ACA. Certainly when it comes to climate change, the legislature did not say, wouldn't it be nice if everyone volunteered to increase our renewable energy portfolio? We mandated a 50% and now 100% renewable portfolio standard by a reasonable date. Why with homelessness, which is the epic crisis of our time, is everything we do voluntary and optional? We should mandate ourselves before we mandate the individual, mandate ourselves to create enough capacity to bring people indoors. And that's what I am calling for as a matter of state law.
So, Mayor Steinberg, I understand the emphasis on the government or the larger entity to be mandated to provide this. In your example of public schools, children, though, are required by law to attend school. And in your example of healthcare, Californians now are required under a mandate to have healthcare or they pay a penalty. So the piece that's important is what you're saying about people who are living unsheltered and homeless. What is the mandate on them as people in connection with what you want to have happen in government?
Well, two-part answer. First of all, if government is required at all levels, the state, the counties, and the cities, to create enough capacity to bring people indoors and are driven towards that legal imperative, I believe that 80% or so of the unsheltered homeless population, if we meet them where they're at, will actually come indoors. And those with mental health and substance abuse issues, of course, cannot get better living under a freeway overpass. It's only when they're indoors can we help them. For the other 20% that may be treatment resistant, my belief is once the government does create that sufficient capacity, that there ought to be an obligation on the individual as well to come indoors. But that isn't the emphasis of my advocacy at this point, because frankly, we don't have the moral high ground or the legal high ground to call that question until we actually establish and then implement the government's obligation to first bring people indoors.
You're the mayor of a city. Is your hope, though, that you're going to be able to take this to a state level and make your vision a state law?
Well, the governor has given me the honor of or the responsibility, maybe the burden of co-chairing his homeless task force. And with Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas from Los Angeles, we are leading a 14-member group of California leaders. And we are going to make a set of what I call interim recommendations to the governor, public recommendations within the next several weeks. And so I hope that this provocative, but I think vital idea is going to be a part, a major part of those recommendations. And we will allow the public process and the debate to begin.
All right, Mayor Steinberg, always a pleasure. I know you're heading off to an event that starts in 3 minutes, so we're going to let you go. And good wishes to you and your family and your staff for a happy holiday season.
You the same. Happy holidays, Beth, to you and all of your listeners. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mayor Steinberg. Thanks, too, to Professor Jacobs, who has stayed in the studio with us. So happy holidays to you as well. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. Up next, we're going to shift gears and talk about holiday movies and then some music, too. You are listening to Insight on CAP Radio. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. At the box office, the holiday season has already begun with big movies rolling out and more big movies set to open this weekend and through the Christmas holiday. Derek Bang is here. He's an author, freelance journalist, and Peanuts historian who writes regularly about movies. We have popped the popcorn to add a little ambience to the studio. Hi, Derek.
Good morning, Beth. How you doing?
Are you busy going to theaters?
Oh, my goodness. This is where I start to feel like a mushroom in the dark so often.
What is your broad impression of this holiday movie season?
It is varied. We have the popcorn pleasure, speaking of which, with the Jumanji sequel, which is a lot of fun.
Still number one right now at the box office.
And it deserves that. It's very entertaining. It's one of those rare sequels that is pretty much as good as its predecessor. And then we have real dark stuff, such as Dark Waters and Richard Jewell and Bombshell, serious topics, which is typical for this time of year. We get the high-profile Academy Award contenders.
Right. Let's start with Dark Waters. It opened nationwide December 6th. A little synopsis of this movie, and then we'll listen to a clip.
Mark Ruffalo, and just as a passing comment, I would like to nominate him as this generation's Henry Fonda, Jimmy Stewart. Mm. He has that graceful ability to embrace a passionate cause while still feeling like a guy that you could sit in the backyard with and share a beer. His commitment to a role is terrific, and he projects sincerity so well. He plays corporate defense attorney Robert Bilott, who was contacted by a friend of his grandmother's one day, a farmer whose cattle were dying unexpectedly and in unprecedented numbers. Farmer was convinced that it had something to do with the waste dump that DuPont had set up in a neighboring piece of property. Now, the interesting thing about the story is that Bilott was a corporate defense attorney who generally defended companies such as DuPont. But the more he learned about this case, the more he realized that this was something very, very bad. But what he couldn't have realized, because this started in the late 1990s, was that this case would occupy his attention for the next 20 years.
And this is inspired by a true story. Here's a bit from the trailer for Dark Waters.
Almost heaven, West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains.
Hi, Grammers.
What are you doing here?
Your grandma tells me her grandson's some fancy environment lawyer down in Cincinnati.
I am a corporate defense attorney.
So?
I defend chemical companies.
Well, now you can defend me.
How many did you lose?
190.
190 cows.
You tell me nothing's wrong here.
It's a small matter for a family friend. Help a guy who needs it.
The farmer or you? That's chemicals, I'm telling you.
I'm seeing documents. I don't understand.
They're hiding something.
All right, that's Dark Waters. It's already in theaters. I'm really excited to see this one.
Definitely. And I would call attention to the fact that the script is based on Nathaniel Rich's terrific January 2016 New York Times Magazine article. It's worth reading because it will both amplify what you watched in the film. And frankly, it's a very scary story that took a long time to develop.
All right, the next one we're going to talk about is Knives Out. It opened nationwide on Thanksgiving Day. I think we're not going to say anything about it. Just go into the trailer. And maybe the movie is, I'm going to prepare you here, as weird as this might sound.
I think you have something you want to tell me.
Harlan started out with a Rusty Smith Corona and built himself into one of the best-selling mystery writers of all time.
30 languages, over 80 million copies sold. You guys fans?
I mean, I don't do much fiction reading myself.
Big fan. I'm a big fan.
Who is that guy?
Mr. Blanc is a private investigator of great renown.
I read a tweet about a New Yorker article about you. You're famous.
The night of his demise, the family had gathered to celebrate your father's 85th birthday. And your son, Ransom, did he attend as well?
Yes, but he left early. I think Linda was upset.
Walt would get a little Irish courage in him. He'd get into it with Harlan.
What?
Richard said what?
Are you baiting me, detective?
Attempting to be thorough so we can figure out the matter.
It just goes on and on.
This is a wonderful send-up of Agatha Christie-style drawing room murder mysteries. And it's constructed very much in the model of Gosford Park, which came out a while back, where it's both a fair murder mystery. If you pay very close attention, you can get ahead of what's going on. And at the same time, the characters are so wonderfully exaggerated. We have a multimillion-dollar book author who is found dead, a knife lying next to him, and then this wonderful southern-fried Gothic-style private investigator played by Daniel James Bond Craig, doing a perfect Southern accent, comes in to investigate this case. And he has this wonderful line at one point where he's talking to the young woman who was the caregiver of the murder victim. And he says to her that he understands that she suffers from, and this is a direct quote, a regurgitative reaction to mistruthing. Which means that if she lies, she vomits.
She vomits.
So she's a two-legged lie detector, which is just a wonderful gimmick that is used throughout the entire story. And it builds to a fantastic climax when all of the suspects are gathered.
Right now, it was the number three movie at the box office. So I said Jumanji is number one. Disney wins the number two spot with Frozen 2 right now.
Well, of course.
And then comes Knives Out with Jamie Lee Curtis, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
All kinds of people.
Oh, there are so many different options. I'm talking with Derek Bang. Let's go to one that so many people are anticipating, a production of this poem from T.S. Eliot that we've seen in so many different ways, but this will be a movie unlike any other. Cats opens tomorrow, December 20th. Here's a bit from the trailer.
Tonight is a magical night where I choose the cat that deserves a new life.
Going to the ball could get dangerous.
Come on! Let's dance!
I judge a cat by its soul.
I've got plenty of soul.
Spotlight and a drum roll, please.
Milk!
It's party time.
The most deserving cat will be reborn into another life.
So many deserving cats in this film. This is an A-list of stars, from Taylor Swift to Judi Dench, who we were hearing right there. What a lineup.
Well, and the operative word was the one that she mentioned at the very beginning of that clip, and it's magical. Visually, this film is stunning. In a just slightly less than 2-hour film that is filled with incredible dance sequences, the standout is the one that was done by Skimbleshanks, a tap dance sequence. He's the railway cat. Mm-hmm. And the way that dance opens out, starting in the dilapidated theater where all of the Jellicle cats assemble, and all of a sudden, seamlessly, they are dancing on train tracks out in the real world. Mm. The employment of special effects and the choreography. And yes, the casting you mentioned is fun, but it's important to bear in mind that they are stunt casting small parts. The real stars are the Royal Ballet performers who handle all of the amazing choreographed routines throughout. It's just so much fun to watch, allowing for the fact that there's really no story. It's a series of bravura. Yes. That's production numbers strung together. And of course, most people aren't going to mind.
An age-old conversation about cats. Jennifer Hudson, who is one of the cats, was talking about having to go to cat school, as the actors did. They were blindfolded and had to walk around the room smelling and thinking and just sniffing and trying to be in full cat mode.
And it's amazing the degree to which so many of them accomplished that. There were times where I admittedly briefly forgot that I was watching people. They really behave like cats.
Although Judi Dench as a cat?
Well, she's a very old cat.
All right, let's move on to the big Christmas Day opening. Greta Gerwig and her take on Little Women. Let's listen to a bit of the trailer.
I'm working on a novel. It is a story of my life and my sister's.
Make it short and spicy. And if the main character is a girl, make sure she's married by the end.
Ow, Joe!
I want to be an artist in Rome and be the best painter in the world.
That's what you want too, isn't it, Joe, to be a famous writer?
Yes, but it sounds so crass when she says it.
My girls have a way of getting into mischief.
Well, so do I.
This is Meg, Amy, Beth, and Joe.
I intend to make my own way in the world.
No one makes their own way, least of all a woman. You'll need to marry well.
But you are not married, aren't you?
Well, that's because I'm rich.
Did you get the voice there? That was Meryl Streep.
Of course. Isn't Meryl Streep in every other movie these days?
I know. Based on the classic book, I'm so excited for this film. But, of course, in this region, we're especially excited because hometown girl Greta Gerwig is the director.
Well, and the scripter.
And the scripter, and which is important.
She did a masterful job of not only adapting the novel, but this is very key with books that were written so long ago. There is a danger involved in bringing too much contemporary stuff into a fresh adaptation. And what I admire so much about Gerwig's handling of the material is the way she's both faithful to Louisa May Alcott, yet at the same time, she very sneakily works in enough contemporary feminist attitude that it doesn't feel wrong. It feels as progressive as we suspect Alcott herself probably was back in the day.
This was a powerful book when I was young. My mom asked us to call her Marmy for more than a year.
Really?
Because of this story. And she had named each of us, Beth,
Yeah. Okay.
My sister Michelle was named for Meg. Anne was named for Amy. It is really an important story. Greta Gerwig, you have some long ago friendship time with Greta.
She is my one best attachment to rising Hollywood royalty, and this is very exciting. Back in 2000, I was music director and pianist for a Woodland Opera House production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. And Greta, who was 16 at the time, was cast as Patty. Mm. She was by far the youngest cast member. She was also by far the most professional, even at 16. Sometimes you can tell. It was such a joy to work with her at that point in time. And she was always very self-conscious because that play came out at a point in time when Patty, one of the original characters, was on her way out of the strip. She was very soon to be eclipsed by Peppermint Patty, who's an mm-hmm. entirely different character. Mm-hmm. And we brought that show on the road, so to speak, to a Peanuts convention that took place that summer in Santa Rosa. And there was a buyer's market that occupied most of the Saturday prior to the performance. And she was very upset because she spent the whole day trying to find anything that had Patty on it and having absolutely no luck.
Oh.
And she was tickled to death before the performance that evening when I brought her a little pin of Patty that I had found that day. And I've wondered if she kept it.
Well, you mentioned that she did the script writing on the adaptation of Little Women. If you want a great laugh, go back to her guest appearance on David Letterman from 2013. She's talking about having written Frances Ha and starring in it as her first movie. It's a hilarious segment. It is worth going back to look to. David Letterman from 2013 with Greta Gerwig.
Outstanding. So I'll do that.
We wish her all the best. All right. We just have a little bit of time left. Can we talk about Richard Jewell as a movie?
Sure.
I happened to be covering the Olympics. I was in the hotel next to it and that night. I was right up over the park, woken up by the bombing and the emergency vehicles. So I'm one of these people that is so much anticipating this movie, but I'm hearing but one thing they did with the character.
Oh, my God. This is so disappointing. As good as the film is, and we should probably explain real quickly that it is about the title character, Richard Jewell, who was the security guard who found the backpack containing the bomb.
In Centennial Park in Atlanta.
And alerted people, security police forces, to move folks back, and was absolutely undeniably responsible for far fewer people being hurt and or killed than would have been. So he was a hero for 3 days. And then after 3 days, a sad combination of events led him to be
the
prime suspect. And he spent the next 88 days basically barricaded in the apartment that he shared with his mother while the media tried and convicted him. And of course, it turned out that he was, in fact, innocent. He was, in fact, a hero. Years later, somebody else confessed to having been the bomber. Clint Eastwood's approach to the film is very matter of fact. The performances by Paul Walter Hauser and Kathy Bates as Richard and his mother are just amazing. I mean, the degree of intimacy that they achieve in some of their saddest moments is so painful that as a viewer, you feel like a voyeur. But a sidebar character played by Olivia Wilde, who plays a real reporter, Kathy Scruggs, who worked for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, who was one of the prime forces in driving the impression that Jewell was a suspect, is a cartoon in this movie. She's a rapacious, vindictive, nasty slut, to be blunt, and it is completely unfair, and it unbalances the movie. And it is also ironic that a film which at its very core is about character assassination is in fact itself guilty of character assassination. And since Kathy died in 2001, she's not around to defend herself.
Her editor has spoken out about it too and felt that the depiction was all of the words that you said.
Oh, it's unforgivable, even in a dramatic sense.
So that is Richard Jewell. We have about 30 seconds left. Bombshell and Star Wars are going to open on Friday. They haven't screened here in Sacramento. I know you haven't seen them. But what about the Baby Yoda marketing plan? The decision to hold back on all those plushy stuffies this Christmas.
Oh, my goodness. So is that a cart before the horse situation or what? Are we driving up anticipation and excitement? Oh, I think so.
Are you going to end up having a Baby Yoda on your shelf someday?
Absolutely not. I draw the line. The only thing on my shelf are about 75 Snoopy plush dolls.
All right. Well, we're going to have another conversation about movies on Netflix and Amazon Prime and all the streaming. But one final note about them and their eligibility for the Academy Awards when made-for-TV movies aren't. Is there something wrong there?
Well, it's a long conversation. My understanding at this point is that the basic rule still holds firm. If a film wishes to be considered for Oscars, it has to play at a theater somewhere for at least, I think, 2 weeks. Generally, that's one theater in New York and one theater in Los Angeles. And traditionally, they would then open in 3,000 theaters in January or February. These days, the tradition is they go to Netflix or Amazon Prime. What that's doing to Hollywood, I don't think we know yet.
All right, that's the conversation in 2020, okay?
Looking forward to it.
Happy holidays, happy movies. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Beth. It's always a pleasure to be had.
That is Derek Bang, author and freelance journalist. You can find more about the movies and links to the trailers so you can see them and hear them at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. Dennis Newhall is standing by. Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Who is still holiday shopping? I am. Are you Dennis Newhall?
I don't do such a thing.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a whole other story. This is a big shopping weekend online and in stores for a lot of people, with Hanukkah beginning the evening of this Sunday, December 22nd, ending the 30th. Christmas Day is Wednesday, December 25th, and Kwanzaa is December 26th to January 1st. Now we're moving into a holiday tradition with Dennis, and that is that he checks out the new boxed music sets for us, and that's his holiday sound advice.
I'm going to blow your entire holiday budget this morning.
Okay. That sounds good. Where do you want to start?
Well, I'll start with Abbey Road. A couple of these have been around for a few months, but Abbey Road, it's the third in a series that Giles Martin has tackled. And as you would expect, it's beautiful. Beth is looking through it right now to see some pictures I've never seen, which is always fun.
Oh.
And it's just a really nice, well-put-together set. Musically, though, remastered, incredible care taken to try and bring out with new technology some of the sound that may have gotten hidden simply by using tape and earlier mastering processes. Plus, this one, as usual, comes with a Dolby Atmos and a 5.1 mix on the Blu-ray disc. So those of you who have high-end setups are going to hear some things you haven't heard before. Now, as far as the bonus tracks on here, there's two albums of outtakes, a couple of whole songs that haven't been anywhere else, and studio chatter, which is a lot of fun. It may not be anything you listen to more than once, but this is a beautiful album, and it's worth having. Certainly a great gift.
It's actually a coffee table book.
It is.
With the CDs or the Blu-rays in pockets inside the book, which is really lovely. Let's listen to a little music, though. We're going to hear something.
Something in the way she moves attracts me like no other lover. Something in the way she woos me. I don't want to leave now. You know I believe in how.
That was a beautiful beautiful song just as a demo. George Harrison was something. And that reminds me, if I was to pick between Sgt. Pepper the White Album and Abbey Road as a gift for somebody who didn't have any of them, I would go with the White Album because it's just a treasure chest of demos. And it's great to hear them when they were just working up songs.
How much of the budget goes to Abbey Road?
They're about $80, $90.
Okay. All right. Where are we moving to next?
Welcome to the Vault, Steve Miller.
Okay.
For people who were fans of the Steve Miller Band in the early days with Quicksilver Girl and Living in the USA, he's been very reluctant to go back to that period and pull anything out of the vaults. In fact, he was late in remastering those early albums. Mm. This is a really nicely put together box set. You're looking at it now and you can see, I think the ridiculousness started when Pink Floyd gave away coasters and scarves. Steve Miller gives you a whole bunch of guitar picks.
Yeah, with the emblem emblem right on the pick. Yes.
But there's also some really nice pictures in there and stories about the music. And this is a combination of live studio outtakes, some songs you've never heard before. There's a performance in here with Chuck Berry. There's a performance with family friend Les Paul. And the sound is all top quality. So
these books are beautiful, Dennis.
Oh,
both
yeah.
Both of them.
Whenever a box set comes out, it's nice if they do a nice job like these two.
Wow. Okay. Price tag.
It's about $80.
$80.
But you'd really
well.
Need to be a Steve Miller fan to go buy this one.
Okay. Should we listen to
sure.
30 seconds?
About Billy Joe and Bobby Sue, two young lovers with nothing better to do than sit around a house.
Can I leave the show and just go listen right now? Will you take us to the end here?
That's such a nice take on that song. That was one of my favorite parts of this.
Fabulous.
And you also get to hear a lot more of Steve Miller's playing in some of these live tracks than you do on the usual studio albums.
Okay, we need to get a little quickly through Dylan and Cash.
Traveling through Bob Dylan, part of the bootleg series, isn't really even a box set, but it's worthwhile. I think this is the best deal. Three CDs of the sessions from the late 60s, early 70s, when Johnny Cash joined in, and they those sessions produced John Wesley Harding and Nashville Skyline. But there's some great duets with Johnny Cash. It's only $20
wow.
at Target, but you can't walk in and get it. You have to order it online. I think that's the best place to buy it. 47 previously unreleased recordings. It's called Traveling Through Bootleg Series Volume 15.
All right, this is our holiday sound advice with Dennis Newhall. We're going to jump ahead to Stevie Ray Vaughan.
This one I'm bringing in simply to help save some people some money, not because it's not worth it, but I'll tell you what it is. It's an SACD audiophile, everything he ever did on Epic. It's a big old box that really doesn't have much to offer except a booklet and too much airspace. But for audiophiles, it's supposed to be amazing. The thing is, if you go to buy it on Amazon, it's $840. Just go to the company that makes it, which is Acoustic Design. It's $280.
Really?
Yeah. Now, that's still a lot, but if you want to buy it on vinyl, it's three times that. So if you're a real Stevie Ray Vaughan fan, this is a good one to get. But get the CD version from the company that makes it, not from Amazon. And here's another thing. All of this music is also remastered on a $44 box that came out about 8 years ago. So you got your tiers there. If you want to spend $880, go ahead. But I think Amazon is the one that makes out on that one.
You know, on KZAP, you should do a call-in hour where people can just call you, Dennis, and pick your brain for where to get the music they want for the best deal and the best sound quality. We are going to wrap up with the Beatles and Come Together. But I do want to ask you what you alluded to in the beginning. No holiday shopping? Why not?
I do holiday buying
okay.
on a very limited basis. There's no young kids in my life right now. So there's Christmas, we're all looking at each other saying, you know, let's just save our money and go do something.
Yeah.
And there's just opening gifts, you know.
I think more families make that choice. You always want to celebrate the little ones.
Several of us got together and bought presents for a needy family.
Wonderful.
One particular family. Mm-hmm. I will say one last thing. The Prince 1999 box set for Prince fans is supposed
yes.
to be amazing. Two live shows, a bunch of outtakes and B-sides, and it's in a regular size box at about $80.
Okay, so what do you want to say about Come Together?
Come Together is probably could very well be my favorite Beatles song. And you have to listen to this whole outtake. It doesn't have all of the production in it, but it's there. And Lennon's voice sounds a little rougher. And then it breaks down in the middle. And he makes up a couple of verses that aren't in the song, which, of course, is all those verses are bizarre anyway. But it's just fun to hear a different version of them doing what was one of my favorite songs on probably my favorite Beatles album.
Well, all this information will be on the website. We're going to close with Come Together. I think it's the perfect spirit for the holiday.
One last thing, best rock albums of the year. I'd say Black Keys, the new Who album, and oops, I can't remember the other one. There's one more that's really good. It's not going to come.
All right, interrupt me as soon as you remember.
Okay.
All right. That is Dennis Newhall, and you can hear him Saturday nights from 7 to 8. You got it?
The Raconteurs.
There you go. All right. This is our final Live Insight for 2019. The Insight team will be on holiday. We'll return January 6th with new live shows. Let me say thank you to the team. Besides me, Helen Barrington and Cynthia Lopez, Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, Mark Jones, Anthony Van Hook, Antonio Munez, Matt Pacini. We have Aram Sarkissian as our managing editor. Joe Barr is our chief content officer. Thanks for joining us, and we hope during this holiday season that you and yours can peacefully and kindly come together.